This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup. This season of True Tales of Luxury is proudly sponsored by Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.
It does also feel quite feminist and rule-breaking, which is cool. And I think it was just the right product at the right time.
In this podcast, I talk to designers and creatives at the forefront of the luxury industries. Today, my guest is Olivia von Halle, who's transformed the humble pajama and tracksuit into luxury items and so become a worldwide phenomenon. Combining glamour and practicality, innovation and attention to detail, she's created the go-to brand for anyone looking to blur the line between lounge and ready-to-wear in a super cool, contemporary and fabulous way. With grateful women across the globe embracing the offer of comfort without compromising on style and sexuality. So Olivia, welcome. I have to start by just saying thank you, really, because it's really down to you that I now can wear my pajamas out at night. and I mean out at night rather than in. And I wondered at what point that idea had sort of struck you as being a possibility, because for me, you're probably not as lazy as me. You look very glamorous today in your beautiful yellow dress. But the idea of wearing something comfy with an elasticated waist and being dressed up, well, that just, to me, strikes me as genius.
I was a trend forecaster. So I graduated from university and became a trend forecaster and moved to Shanghai. And while I was out there, I became completely and utterly obsessed with pyjamas, basically. And all I wanted to do was to wear them out. It just felt like a really decadent, modern, sort of new way of dressing. It was quite covered up, but I felt extremely comfortable. They had amazing feel appeal. They were silky. And it just felt really like rebellious and like I was breaking the rules. So I I'm 6 foot tall, for anyone who doesn't know. And I was really struggling to find clothes out in China. So I had an amazing tailor out there. And he made me a couple of pairs of beautiful pajamas, and I started wearing them out and about. And that was in 2008. Yeah, so definitely before the pajama trend hit.
So I have to ask you then what a trend forecaster is, because you mentioned that was your sort of starter job.
Yeah, a trend forecaster is basically someone who works with, whether it's through an agency or works, it's actually like a position at a brand, and they predict fashion trends. So they predict all sorts of trends. So you can be a consumer trend forecaster, or you could predict youth trends or music trends, or yeah, any trend you can think of. They say that half of it is something that you are just born with. So it's about having a very innate sense of being plugged into the zeitgeist and about knowing what people want before they know they want it. And then the other half is just about doing a lot of research and about going to events, I suppose. So, for example, if there's a big exhibition on at the V&A and everyone's going to go and see it, then that's going to have an effect on culture. So it's about being very plugged into culture and picking up on the kind of winds of what's happening.
So you said that you think it's that it is partly innate. So yeah. as a teenager, were you particularly good at recognizing things that were going to become fashionable and so on? What was your where did the interest come from?
As a child, I grew up on a farm in the middle of nowhere, and my parents are very unmaterialistic, to the point where actually brands were banned in our house. So I grew up in the 90s. All I wanted was a jumper that said like Moschino across the front of it. And I wasn't allowed to wear anything at all. So in fact, I had a little, my granny's gardening jumper, which was an old Nike sweatshirt. And I was so proud of it. So anyway, I had no access to clothes. I had the clothes I wore riding, the clothes I went to school in, and then I had a fancy dress box, which thank God was full of all of my grandmother's clothes from the 60s, some of my great grandmother's clothes from the 20s, 30s, and my aunt's clothes, which was spanned from like sort of late 70s till the early 90s.
So was your mother the only generation banning brands? Because it sounds like, you know, the other women in her family embraced fashion with a gusto.
They all made a lot of their clothes. So my grandmother made all of her clothes. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't like an amazing, massive thing, but I basically took what I could from there and just adapted it. So I felt like I wasn't allowed to kind of fit in with what everyone else was wearing. I had to I had no choice to do that. So it was like, okay, if I can't go to New Look and Dorothy Perkins, then I'm going to have to kind of dig into this.
And create your own style.
Yeah, yeah. And it definitely made me really creative with the way I dressed, and it made me quite interested in fashion. And so I think from quite a young age, we had the Daily Telegraph at home. There was no internet. So I would always look at the Telegraph style section and sort of see things on the catwalk. And in my mind, in a farm, I'd be like, well, that's what's in fashion. I mean, the fact it was being worn on a catwalk in Paris, not on the streets of Sevenoaks where I lived, didn't really matter. You know, I was going to wear that thing, and I would go to school with the absolute conviction that, yes, this is what is fashionable, and it's just like Christian Lacroix, and, you know, get over it.
So didn't you once cut up, I think, your grandmother's flapper dress or something in order to customize it?
Oh, I regret that so much. I know. I made it into a top, which I wore to a school disco. It was beaded. It was so beautiful. An absolute travesty. But yeah, I think it definitely made me really interested in the cyclical nature of trends. You're very interested in something, and so you pick up on little signs. And if you're an intuitive person, I think you see these things before other people do. So
do you think that comes a bit from not being exposed to them or not being saturated in them when you were young? I mean, do you think that there is sort of, because that sounds like a sort of 70s childhood, even though it happened in the 90s, you know, but that idea of sort of being off grid, off brands, off all of that stuff. I mean, do you think it was because your imagination was allowed to run riot?
Yeah, definitely. And I am a huge believer in the importance of boredom and fueling creativity. And I think you have to give yourself space for your imagination to be able to run riot. I think it's the big problem, I think, with screens. And I'm hugely anti-screens. I hate that constant scrolling. I think it just kills our creativity. It's really important to be bored and to have time just to sit out and look out of a window. And I had an awful lot of that as a child. And I think it did definitely feel something within me that I can't draw. I didn't go to design school, but I do love clothes, basically, in fashion. And I'm very interested in, I love looking at groups of school children and what they're all wearing. You see, like, I don't know, a gang of kids come past you and they'll all have like one trouser leg slightly rolled up and the other sock pulled up and all wearing the same bag. And I love that. I absolutely love it.
And they think they're so individual, but actually they really do dress like a herd at that age.
But we all dress like tribes. And I find that so interesting, that kind of tribal mentality of how we identify with one another, with what we wear.
So you moved, obviously not literally and immediately, but from Sevenoaks to Shanghai. Which is
quite a few places, thank God. I don't think I would have been ready for Shanghai after Sevenoaks.
Quite a great leap. And you moved there with your husband, but you're both incredibly young, I think, when you went there.
Yeah, yeah.
Why did you go to Shanghai?
We met when I was just finishing university and he'd been working for a year. He's actually younger than me. It took me 5 years to get through uni. I've never excelled at education. And we met, we fell in love, we got engaged unofficially after 3 months, and then we told our parents after like 9 months, and then got married, and he was 23 and I was 25 when we got married.
So young.
We just wanted to go on an adventure, and it was 2008 and everyone was talking about the BRIC countries, so Brazil, Russia, India, China, which one was going to be the one that took off. So we decided we wanted to go and have an adventure in one of these countries. I loved the idea of Brazil. He didn't. He'd been to China, and my best friend had just moved to Shanghai a year before and had loved it. So we decided to move to Shanghai. I'd never been before. And pretty much the day we left, Lehman Brothers collapsed. And it was, my poor friends all graduated from university and were left sort of 2008 in that terrible recession. And I just went off to Shanghai, was just taking off. It couldn't have been more different.
And that's where you worked as a trend forecaster?
Yeah, so initially we both studied Mandarin out there for a year at university together.
How did that go?
I mean, it's really hard. I wish I'd done better. There was a time where I could probably say my Mandarin was conversational. I think now it's, pretty mama hoo hoo for anyone who speaks Chinese. I mean, so. I worked as a trend forecaster for the Future Laboratory and WGSN, just like a China correspondent.
And it does sound like a kind of fin de siècle kind of period in a strange way, because it sounds like it was incredibly decadent. And was there a sense that you were living through a particularly sort of decadent era? I mean, it feels like the 20s or something when you're describing it.
It really did feel like that. I think the Chinese government had suddenly very much sort of relaxed, and now it's clamped down again. So they were relaxed about visas and about late licenses, and they very much are wanting to open Shanghai up to Westerners. The rent was incredibly cheap. We were 23 and 25. We had a full-time butler. What were we doing? I mean, we went out for dinner every night. We'd go to four or five parties a night. Taxis cost 50p. It was an amazing time. I think we were very lucky that we did go there at that time, because it is or is going to be the global superpower. And I feel very lucky to know a small amount about Chinese culture and have Chinese friends and have experienced that. Yeah.
It also seems to have influenced you enormously in, you know, creating your brand, because obviously, you know, in a way, you know, China's kind of synonymous with silk pajamas to a degree. Was the creation of the brand inspired by your lifestyle? Because at a certain point in the evening, you just wanted to pull off your heels and whatever dress you'd got dressed up in and put on something comfy to get stuck in for the long haul.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly why we did it. And so I sort of come back from nights out wearing some ridiculous outfit, and I'd change into my pajamas and put crazy earrings on, like the ones I'm wearing today. And and we just drink gin and tonics on our balcony looking out over the city and have a really fun time. It was like the perfect way to spend your mid-20s.
You're really being quite irritating. I just think I want to put that out there right now.
Can I say that is no longer my life, sadly.
Yes, now you have two children you're saddled with and your pajamas will come in handy. Was there a sort of light bulb moment in terms of, you know, you described how you had this tailor and you got the tailor to make you up some really gorgeous, luxurious pajamas because that's what you felt like wearing.
Yeah.
What was the moment when you realized that actually your penchant for nightwear might actually be shared?
I'd made these pajamas. I basically wore them all the time. So I'd go out to dinner in them. I think I spent my 26th birthday party wearing them. And I loved how they made me feel, really sort of rebellious. And I would wanted to set up a company. So I think one of the great things about Shanghai at that time is it had this amazing entrepreneurial spirit. Everyone was setting up companies, and there was very much a feeling that you could just do anything out there. I'd been thinking about a few different ideas, and none of them had really stuck. I wanted to do a dog food company.
I bet you're glad you didn't now.
Oh my God, I'm now a vegetarian. I can't think of anything worse than dealing in raw meat. We had all sorts of crazy ideas. And the whole time there I was, first of all, having these pajamas for myself, and then I started making them for friends and family as Christmas presents. And so this idea was sort of sitting under my nose the whole time. And it was like the slowest ever eureka moment. I think I went back to London, ended up taking about 40 friends sort of inside leg measurements and measuring them all up. So get my tailor to make you some. And I came back and he said, you know, this is crazy. It takes me 2 days to make one pair of these pajamas. Like, I can't make 40 pairs. You need to go to a factory. And I was like, oh, this is it. This is what I should do. And I did a bit of market research, and at the time, I mean, now there's so many different pajama brands, but at the time there was absolutely nothing like it. We really were the first, and of our kind of generation, like redefining pajamas and doing them in a different way. So I just thought, this is it.
Do you think that something was changing in terms of women and how they were dressing and feeling about themselves as well, that seemed to coincide with that whole idea? Because the sort of confidence that it takes to step out in something that isn't figure-hugging and necessarily instantly perceived as feminine.
Yeah.
It seems to be quite a theme as well.
Yeah, it was definitely the end of the kind of Hervé Léger bandage dressing thing with, you know, massive high heels. And that sort of very tight bodycon look was definitely kind of drawing to a close. And I think that with trends, the pendulum always swings. So it felt very, it felt very modern to kind of suddenly wear something that was a little bit more oversized, but did still have sex appeal.
But that's what you sort of added to the pajama, isn't it? Rather than, I mean, obviously the idea of a pair of silk pajamas has always had an essence of luxury about it.
Yeah. I mean, Coco Chanel was the first woman to ever wear silk pajamas. She used to wear her lovers in bed. And then she started wearing them on the beach in Cannes in 1920s. Beach pajamas then became a huge trend. And that was the start of women wearing trousers ever.
Really? So
that, yeah, it all started with beach pajamas that then turned into, yeah, women having the confidence to start wearing trousers. So I think it does also feel quite feminist and rule-breaking, which is cool. And it just, I think it was just the right product at the right time.
And did you originally set out to do it in the way that, that you were wearing pajamas, which was as kind of going out nightwear?
Yeah.
Or did you set out to make pajamas for people to slide into their beds in?
Oh, no, I always thought that people should wear them out. Yeah, but I always wanted them to be comfortable enough to be able to jump into bed and after. Yeah.
So like my sequin pair that I have at home, that they wouldn't have got the nod of approval from you.
Well, I mean, I think it's, yeah, we've never really done a sort of a pajama that you can't sleep in. I think for me, I've always liked the fact that you can do both. It just feels very modern to be, I don't want to feel sort of trussed up and feel sort of, you know, tight and scratchy anymore. Like I'm a woman. I want to feel, you know, relaxed in what I'm wearing.
Do you think that's actually one of the great luxuries, is to be able to dress beautifully, but also feel incredibly relaxed and comfortable?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's part of the reason that trainers have been so in fashion for the last few years, is that we've got really busy lives now. Everyone's dashing around and you want to feel amazing, but also feel really comfortable. So all the dresses that we now make, that is sort of in their DNA. They need to feel amazing. We always talk about feel appeal at work. The way that something feels, everything feels absolutely beautiful. And I love that thing of being kind of cocooned in whatever you're wearing and feeling elegant and like things are really beautifully cut. I think that was one of the problems with pajamas at the time, was that a lot of people were making them. People weren't really thinking about them very much. And we really went back to the drawing board with them and tried to make them in the most beautiful, luxurious way that we could, rather than it being something that was just a part of the collection that was like a little sideline.
Yeah, because talk to me about the fabrics, because I think a large part of what sort of defined them as not being necessarily just for sleeping in was that the fabrics were so unusual and striking and the colours so vivid and, again, inspiring.
Yeah, so we started off just using this really beautiful heavyweight silk, which is called a 19 mummy. It was a silk that at the time wasn't really being used very much by anyone because it was really expensive. So it's quite heavy and it's got a really beautiful drape. And I think that's what makes them feel really luxurious. And then we also print everything the traditional way on a silk screen printing. So nowadays, most brands just digitally print, but we actually cut all of the screens. So for a print,
we're looking at a beautiful black flowery, it looks like a sort of tea dress, and some cream silk pajamas with zebras jumping across them.
Yeah, so the process is quite amazing. So every colour that's on the pyjama, there's a different screen, which is then cut. You apply the screen and then you just put on the red and then you take it off and it dries and then you put the next layer on. So it's very time consuming and very expensive, but you get this amazing saturation. So on the back of our pyjamas, on the inside, the print soaks right through. Whereas if you digitally print something, it just sits on the top. If you look really closely at digital printing, you can always slightly see a line of the printer. Whereas with traditional silk screen printing, you get this lovely kind of misregistration and this saturation of colour.
And obviously you could choose to do the digital printing version and probably make an awful lot more money, or certainly make an awful lot quantity-wise in terms of what you make. So what is it in you that makes you choose this sort of artisan approach to it?
When we talk about luxury at Olivia Von Halley, one of the words that we always use is generosity. And I think it's about us being generous to our customers. So we'll often take a cut. Well, you know, that our margin won't be as good on a product because we want to use the most amazing silk cashmere blend. You know, we could use one that was more wool based, but it just doesn't feel quite right, or it doesn't have that beautiful, luxurious shine. So we just always use the best. And then if we have to, you know, make up the difference ourselves in terms of the margin, then that's what we do.
I'm sure there's somebody tearing their hair out as you speak.
My husband, who's the financial director. But that's really important. I think that's what luxury is. And that was one of the things that spurred me on when I first started with the pyjamas, was trying to buy them just at home in England. And they were all so meanly cut. And at the time, the trend was for trousers to be sitting really kind of on the floor. Ankle swingers were very, like, you know, sort of not in fashion, which now they are. And so I just wanted... one of the main things I thought about was just to be able to curl up on the sofa at home and to have the pyjamas completely going over my feet.
You wanted it them draped virtually.
Yeah, and a lot of the cuts of what we do is like that. Like, we often put more fabric in things almost than we need to, because that to me is just, it just feels so much more luxurious when an arm comes right down to the, like, the line of where your rings are on your hand, or... when things, I don't know, when sleeves are bigger than they need to be. Like, we would make so much more money if everything was more scrimpy.
You went on from pyjamas to that other most comfortable but derided of clothing staples, the tracksuit. I think not since Juicy Couture has there been such excitement about the idea of, you know, wearing a tracksuit for the international traveller. But you've taken it right up a level, because, you know, Juicy was quite expensive. People thought, oh, it's crazy to spend £200 on a tracksuit. Now we're talking £1,000. Yeah. But it's... You're swathed in cashmore, basically, in a Missy tracksuit, aren't you?
Yeah,
so
you are.
How did that come about?
That happened because I was traveling so much at the time. I think I went through a period where I was only in England for 2 weeks. I took something like 76 long haul flights in a year. It was absolutely crazy, and I'm glad I don't really have to do that anymore. But it was in the early stages of the business where I was doing everything myself, and I just wanted something that I could wear to the airport, felt sort of chic enough that I might be upgraded in.
Always important to try.
And that then if I was lucky enough to be upgraded, I could, you know, wear to the lounge and feel good. Then, you know, could kind of snuggle up in on the plane, which are always freezing, and then get off the other side and go straight into a meeting. So, yeah, we created the Missy tracksuit, which is an £1,000 tracksuit, but it is absolutely beautiful. And it's 15%. Cashmere and 85% silk. So it's actually mainly silk that's been knitted, which is really unusual. And the way we do it is, it's like a double-faced technique. So the inside and the outside are the same. So there's no kind of back. So it feels just as amazing when you touch on the front as it does when you put it on.
It sounds like you've immersed yourself in the technicalities of cloth as a part of the process of creating your brand. Is that fair to say? Because, I mean, I can't imagine it was something you knew that much about before you set up.
No, I mean, I study fashion management. So no, I didn't have any technical training. I think I'm very passionate about how things feel. I always make sure that I wear all of our pieces, and I'm very critical about where we put labels, how soft the labels are. It's just those kind of details, like when we use elastic, does it still feel really nice? I just think it's really important that our customers have the same experience in our other products that they do in our pyjamas. No other garment is as nice to wear. Yeah, I want that all the time.
We all want that all the time, and so do people like Rihanna, Jennifer Lopez, Bella Hadid. Do you think they're all trying to get upgraded when they buy your practice, by the way?
I think they're probably getting on their private jets.
But how much does that, you know, celebrity endorsement matter? How much difference does it make? Because you are very favoured.
It definitely makes a massive difference. We're really lucky to have amazing customers, and a lot of them are customers. They just buy from us.
I mean, as opposed to you having to dress them head to toe in a marketing exercise.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're a small British brand. We can't afford to pay, you know, Gigi Hadid, goodness knows how much you're meant to pay her to wear something down the street. I mean, she's worn, I think, the pink or the grey Missy tracksuit she's worn over 2 years. I mean, she seems to just never take it off.
You'd be bankrupt if you were paying her. I mean,
it's an amazing feeling to create clothes that people like that, who have access to all the clothes in the world that they want, that the clothes that they're actually drawn to and they want to put on again. And I think that's what yeah, that's the reason they want to is because they feel amazing on, and that's the most important thing for us, yeah.
And I think you've moved into bridal wear now, which seems to me an enormous leap into the what I wouldn't have predicted if I was a trend forecaster. I wouldn't have predicted for you to do, especially as someone who got married, I think, in like a pink tracksuit.
Oh, yeah, I got married in a pink catsuit.
Pink catsuit.
Well, we did a bridal collection. It was quite a long time ago, though.
And then you got bored.
But I think then we were just like, oh, bridal's not really our scene. We always make dresses that people can wear. I don't think we'll ever create a dress for someone who wants, you know, a traditional bridal experience. But I think for people who are looking for something a bit different, then, yeah, we do create some really beautiful dresses that do work really well for bridal.
And now you've moved into ready-to-wear, haven't you? On a more sort of, I don't know, a more, you know, fashion label basis, you know. So is that something you feel comfortable with? Are you excited, trepidatious? I mean, I know you've already started, as it were.
I'm so excited about it. I think it's something we've wanted to do for a long time, and it's something that we've kind of approached in quite a slow way. It sort of started off with the Missy tracksuit in 2016. And then the Issa slip dress has taken off and been worn by all sorts of celebrities on the red carpet. But
when you designed the Issa slip dress, were you just thinking sort of night dress into nightwear?
No, to me, this has always been something you would just wear out. I love wearing it to weddings. And it, I mean, it's quite a naughty thing, but...
Well, it's just like a bias cut. Yeah, it's sexy.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, now we've moved into doing much more proper dresses, but I think they still really have our brand DNA. And yeah, the ready to wear is just growing, 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 and is now actually accounting for like half of all our sales already.
So do you feel now that you are a fully fledged design company?
Oh yeah, definitely. We've just opened this amazing new townhouse on Bedford Square in Bloomsbury, which is absolutely beautiful.
And do you still make everything in Shanghai?
Yeah, we do. I think it just makes sense because silk is our makes up like 99% of what we're creating. And China's the home of silk, so.
But is there a sort of perception problem that you've had to overcome? Because unfortunately, or I don't know, fortunately, China has become synonymous with sort of bulk and cheap goods and so on. And what you're making is the exact opposite.
Yeah, I think in the beginning there was, especially when we were showing people the collection buyers, that there was always a slight sort of, China. But I think now, well, A, people have been buying our products for years and can see that the quality is amazing and, you know, they fall in love with the product. And so that becomes less important to them. But also we've done a lot of work trying to educate customers about manufacturing in China. So Hangzhou, where we have everything made, is the end of the Silk Road. I mean, it's where all silk comes from. So even when people say, oh, you know, silk made in Italy, it's Chinese silk. It's just being printed in Italy. China, you know, they invented silk and they really, really know how to work with silk. And it's an extremely skilled process. We have looked at manufacturing in the UK, but they don't have the skills here to be able to make it, which is really sad. So something like we put like hand-rolled silk piping on all of our pajamas. So you basically take a piece of rope and then you wrap silk around it, and that's how you make the piping. And here they just look at you like you're crazy and say, why don't you just buy piping on the roll? And it's like, well, that's not how we want to do it, you know. So it's we've had an amazing experience out there, and I think now the Chinese luxury market is the world's biggest market, so we have a lot of advantages making there as well.
Although you've created a brand that really epitomizes luxury, we've also asked you to bring along something that you consider to be a luxury. And it's in a very small bag, so I'm thinking it's probably not pajamas unless they're very skimpy.
No, it's not pajamas. It is a necklace which my husband gave to me 10 years ago.
It looks silver from here, or white gold. Or...
So it's a sphere, which has got four diamond...
Doesn't it look a bit like that crown that the Queen wears on coronation moments?
It does.
Moments?
It's like an orb. Is it called an orb? Yeah.
It is like an orb.
So it's got these four claws which come down. And then if you undo the claws, then it opens out and it's actually a talisman.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love things that do that have secrets.
I know.
Because it's got like the little...
Six pyramids
with... But they're all inscribed.
Yeah.
They're
sort of like
things.
Ancient Masonic symbols of protection.
That's really
clever. And then it's also got my old initials in it and like our old family crest. So it was sort of like a...
Oh, that's so romantic.
It was very, yeah.
Did he clearly had it made for you?
Well, can I just say that I love my husband dearly, but he's really bad at choosing presents. So I actually had it made for me, told him to get it, as with every present. I'm sorry, darling.
How clever of you.
Yeah.
Because this really is exceptional. So where did you have it made? Beautiful.
It was made by a guy in Italy. He's only ever made, I think he's made 8 of them. And he's very spiritual. And a friend of mine, I met this amazing woman who had one. We've since become friends. And I was absolutely obsessed with it. And she said, well, I'll give you the guy's email who makes them. But, you know, it took me sort of 5 years to persuade him to make one. So good luck, basically. So I emailed him the next morning and he said, how funny, I had a dream last night that someone was going to get in touch and ask for one. And I said to myself when I woke up this morning that I'll say yes to the next person who does. So I was so lucky.
You are just born lucky. That's just really annoying.
It was really lucky. And I love it so much. I love how surprising it is. I love that it sort of holds this secret inside it. He said to me to open it up every time I was in a place that I felt really good in, and so to allow the good energy to kind of infiltrate it. I mean, goodness knows.
Are you spiritual?
I mean,
really a
when
little
I wear
bit.
That, yes.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And it's got a sort of, there's something covert about it as well, because if you're just wearing it as the orb,
yeah,
then nobody knows the secrets it contains within, do
no,
they?
Exactly.
Do you like that about it too?
I do, yeah, absolutely. And I always feel quite protected when I wear it. I don't know, so much has happened. We've been married for 11 years and so much has happened in our lives. And it's really nice to have something just from that first year that we got married. It feels very sort of romantic.
I've got one last challenge for you before I let you leave, which is just if I let you loose in Harrods today and you could go anywhere and spend time there, which department do you think you'd choose?
Oh, women's wear. Definitely.
You know, you're the first person who said that.
Really?
Yeah, we've had a lot of the food hall.
We've had
jewellery quite a bit.
Yeah.
But no, not women's wear so far.
Oh no, I love clothes. I would love to be let loose in my friend Alessandra Rich in her space. She's a great, great friend of mine, and she makes dresses that are so beautiful, but the dresses that they're very much dresses to wear to extremely smart parties. And I just absolutely love what she does. So I would go mad in Alessandra Rich.
Do you know, I might follow you there, because I wore one of her dresses to this thing in Cannes the other day. And, you know, it was just one of those things that just made you feel amazing.
I mean, yeah.
And it was quite simple. But it's a bit like your it's a slip dress, isn't it? You know, if you describe it, is it bias cut?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, good. Yeah, it is.
No. I always liked a bias. I always favoured a bias cut slip dress.
Very flattering.
Thank you very, very much. It's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you
so much for having me.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Olivia von Halle. That was the final edition in the series, but you can find all the episodes on your usual podcast platforms. The series was recorded in Harrods in London. Thank you to our sponsor, Visa. Visa, everywhere you want to be.